Welcome to a special edition of the Future of Business Energy podcast for Empower Business Solutions Energy HQ. In this session, we are going back to the future. In 2011, Empower Business Solutions worked with the Grantham Research Institute at the London School of Economics on a major project, the Future Report, which predicted four energy scenarios out to 2020. As of now, in 2020, we wanted to look back to see whether any of the predictions came true, as well as look forward to what the sector can expect in the short, medium and long term, and what this means for business. We have spoken to the author of the original report, Professor Sam Fankhauser, as well as Ayan Gavecki, Assistant Director of Energy Policy Intensive Industries Team at the Department for Business, Energy and Industrial Strategy, Robert Buckley, Head of Retail and Relationship Development at Cornwall Insight, and Ben Spry, Head of Flexibility Services at Empower Business Solutions Energy HQ. So thank you very much for joining us on this special podcast. It was really interesting for us to look back at the four scenarios that were outlined in the original report. So current intent, new dash for gas, spiralling costs and investment shortfall, and sort of assess sort of which, if any, best reflect where the energy sector is today in 2020. So Sam, as the author of the original report, if I could come to you first, which of the scenarios do you believe we're closest to today in 2020?
I think what sort of comes out of the scenarios for me is maybe three things. One is still a nervousness about renewables and the cost of renewables. You know, there's scenarios in there where the cost of offshore wind are stubbornly high, I think it says in one spiraling cost in one of the scenarios. So that nervousness was still there. So renewables were unproven at the time. There was a huge implicit or explicit enthusiasm about the potential for shale gas. It was probably the height of sort of the shale gas expectations when we did those scenarios. So we talk about the new golden age for gas, which obviously hasn't materialized, but that was a sentiment at the time. And then we were way too pessimistic, I would say, it depends on where you come from, about coal. And there's a hell of a lot of coal in those scenarios compared to where we currently are. You know, even in scenarios, just sort of the one progressive scenario that we have in there, the current intent one, which is probably too optimistic about clean energy, not about renewables, but it talks about CCS being ready for deployment. Even in that scenario, there's a hell of a lot of coal that we no longer have. So those are the things that struck me when I was rereading the scenarios.
That's interesting. Thanks. And Ben, from an Empower perspective, what do you think?
I don't think any of them depict it 100%, but there are elements of it. Other than the dash for gas, I think there's elements of all of them. But I think we're not a huge distance away from the current intent. So what would I say about it? I'd say, yeah, although the policy landscape hasn't evolved as quickly as assumed it would, nor are there the kind of market price points in order to properly incentivize investment, I still think a lot of what they say in there still rings true. And while this was the intent of kind of rising non-commodity costs, I think, to kind of really stimulate that investment, I think what's hindered it is, I guess, the dramatic fall in commodity costs over that same period has offset that. And what's that been driven by? We've seen, well, certainly recently, we've had really, dampened demand caused by two really lukewarm winters, which I think has taken us all by surprise, but is probably a sign of things to come. And a really uncertain kind of policy landscape at the moment has inhibited progress. Otherwise, I think that that current intent is pretty accurate.
Yeah, it's definitely a mix. I was sort of trying to think where we are. We're probably closest, ironically, to current intent, even though if you interpret it as saying that the government had a plan and implemented it, clearly that's not the way it happened. You know, there was a lot of experimentation and back and throw and haphazard policy making. But in terms of some of the features in there, we're probably close to current intent. It says in there renewables are very cheap, they're ubiquitous. Obviously, the bit about CCS didn't happen. I think that's probably closer to a spiraling cost, I guess, is where that features. Nuclear, same thing. It's probably more a spiraling cost story. The fact that we are heating our homes by gas is a sort of a golden age of gas story rather than a current intent story. But in terms of emissions and the renewable mix and overall where we are, I think we're in current intent to, actually, we're probably better in, not probably, we are better in emissions terms than current intent. So there should have been a fifth scenario that was a things are coming together scenario for renewable.
Well, as you both say, much of what was in the original report, bar sort of a few exceptions, has actually materialised, which is really interesting. But if you were given the benefit of hindsight, and bear in mind where we are now, we're obviously all recording this from home, what for you have been the major factors influencing the sector over the last sort of 12 months to 5 years that we couldn't have predicted nearly a decade ago? Ian, if I could come to you first on this one.
So I've been in my role for quite some time now. Basically, I've joined my position back in 2009, so I've got more than 10 years' experience in the field of policy and the energy market, and particularly on the non-domestic business side. What has struck me, if you look back, is the change in certain technologies in the energy sector, particularly, for example, offshore wind, where the costs have come down, blades have gone bigger, the infrastructure has been built up to connect to the grid, getting those windmills basically out into the ocean. That has changed. Solar PV has changed, particularly the economics again. This has gone massive down. And all these two things have an impact on the electricity system. Batteries, that's relatively a bit more newer, as can come up in the past few years, basically. That has changing and has a potential to change things quite substantially in the future as well. I'm not going to forget about energy efficiency. Expectations are always a little higher that more energy efficiency could have been rolled out. But if you look at previous scenarios about the future demand, what's needed on the energy side and what actually currently is, then basically large part why the demand has been not as big as could have been, as we predicted, basically, is because of energy efficiency. It has probably made a bigger raw impact on the energy system, but you can't see it, energy efficiency, like offshore wind or different new technologies. But it has had a substantial impact as well. Finally, demand-side response, I would say that as well. Basically, how various companies and technologies respond to changes in prices, changes in pressure on the energy system.
And Ian, as well, in hindsight, is there anything that you feel that could or should have been done differently?
Two examples from my perspective is still a great emphasis on energy efficiency, which it's not as simple as it often looks, because if you purely look at the analysis, it makes sense to invest in energy efficiency. But there are all kinds of what economists call transaction costs, basically, that don't make energy efficiency as cheap as we often estimate. So what we could have done is with a better understanding of the civil zones, of, say, barriers or market failures or higher transaction costs within the system to encourage more energy efficiency. The other thing that we probably would have done better as well is CCS. So back in the day, in 2010, we had a commitment on a CCS demonstration project, but that didn't quite materialize, and subsequently funding for that was withdrawn. We are still supporting the technical development, doing a lot of research, but it could have better been the other way around, where you have probably done all the analysis and assessments first, and have a better understanding of what a big demonstration project would look like, and be prepared for that instead of going for it and then subsequently doing all the analysis.
And Sam, coming back to you on this, what do you feel have been the major issues that have impacted the sector?
Well, yeah, there's the obvious one that nobody predicted, like COVID and Brexit. Obviously, COVID is too early to know what on earth it will do in the long term. In the short term, it has proven, not that too many people have sort of taken notice, but it has proven to the insider that we can have much more renewables on the system than people worried at some point, because demand has fallen and renewable supply has sort of in a sense stayed constant and the system has survived. So COVID has sort of taught us that the renewable share can safely be higher than some people might have thought. What Brexit has done is it sort of put the spanner in the works in terms of the carbon pricing regime. You know, the EU ETS will probably not survive the sort of the Brexit transition phase, although we don't know. So we'll have to figure out how carbon will be priced in the power sector. The renewable targets, obviously those are EU targets, they will formally not survive, but the push for renewables will. So I think the contract for differences and the auctions for more renewables, that will survive, that will become part of UK law. So in that sense, Brexit hasn't had that much of an impact there. And then in market terms, yeah, shale gas hasn't happened.
And Robert, we obviously know that Cornwall have done quite a lot in this area, particularly over the recent weeks. What do you think from your side?
If we talk about electricity, it's primarily been decarbonising power generation, the shift to renewables, which has accelerated over the last 5 years. It's got to a point where we're pushing a third, maybe even more sometimes, of power generation on the grid being from renewable sources, so generally wind and solar, a bit of biomass. So it's a very profound shift. But really, I think also the realization that this is only a starting point and that the need to decarbonize has become much more politically accepted since we did the original conversation way back when, which I think I can vaguely remember. And the ambition has also increased as well. I think it's now accepted that power decarbonisation, we can see a path to pretty much doing it. And it's now about heat and transport. And then the other thing that's become very important is how affordable all of this is to the consumer.
And finally, Ben.
Yeah, I mean, you just called it out there. I think the undoubted focus over the last quarter has been coping with COVID and new arrangements as we are, and the impact on energy consumption is, well, and supply in terms of generation is kind of at the forefront of that. So, you know, customers learning to understand what the impact is of kind of selling back overhedged volume into this market or to suppliers and the kind of financial impact of that, certainly, as I mentioned, given where market prices are at the moment, often selling back into very low priced markets, so that there's a financial impact of that. And then I think trying to forecast their recovery in terms of demand, you know, when might kind of we be back to normal, if ever, and how do they get those forecasts right? So I think a lot of kind of discussions and planning in terms of business around how their energy, the way that they use energy, is going to change, I think, in the next kind of 12 to 24 months. I think prior to that, there's a couple of things to call out. I think we saw in last August the huge national trip that was caused by some of the power stations coming offline. And I think for the first time brought it into the kind of public consciousness in terms of it impacted things like, you know, train travel, and it happened at the worst possible time, commuter time on a Friday night. Some businesses came offline as well. So what did that say to businesses? Well, I think that increased the kind of awareness around the need for resilience. And what do we mean by resilience? We mean things that allow you to operate your business if you ever have to without relying on the grid. So definitely brings kind of self-generation on, you know, behind the meter generation back into focus if it wasn't already. So you might have seen it in the focus previously around, well, it's a way of not being exposed to high market prices, or it might be for green credentials. But this is one of the first times that people have stood up and said, actually, we need to make sure that if ever anything goes wrong with the grid, and we could see more of that given, you know, some of that steady inertia that's provided by coal and gas might be disappearing because of the emergence of wind and solar going forward. You know, this could happen more often, and therefore I need to make sure I have that kind of independence from the grid in order to keep my processes going. And I think we mentioned it at the start, but, you know, definitely the emergence of net zero is a compelling need for all. So, you know, yes, it's been around as a kind of an agenda point for a kind of number of years now, but it does feel like that has grown kind of huge legs within the last 12 months, kind of pre-COVID. Certainly in the kind of public sector, and we're starting to see that kind of drift into the private sector as well, and into everyday households. The success of that and how far people have gone is one thing to be debated, but, you know, we're certainly having many, many more conversations with all different types of customers around the net zero agenda and how to kind of help customers to either start on that journey or help them make it a reality. And that really, as I said, has kind of really taken off over the last 12 months.
Thanks very much. You obviously mentioned net zero there, and that's obviously the big target that we're all working to. So net zero carbon emissions by 2050, again, bearing in mind sort of what's happened since that was legislated for 12 months ago and where we are now. Do you believe that this is still achievable? Robert, if I could come to you on this one.
Everything that we see to now is that net zero by 2050 is not only achievable but politically desirable. We've been awaiting an energy white paper for something over 18 months. We are promised that soon. I think that will be a big test of how the government sees the big decisions that need to be taken over the, you know, your 3 years out timelines. Because at the moment, how we are structured, we are not going to get anywhere near a 2015, even an 80% reduction, let alone the net zero that the last government signed us up for. We do need a roadmap, don't we? And is it the white paper? Is it the financing review that is going to come first? And how are the two going to fit together? How does it fit in with the national infrastructure strategy? I think the Committee on Climate Change has been very clear on the kind of decisions that need to be taken and timeframes that they need to be taken in. It'll be politically surprising, I guess, if what the government came out with and said matched what the Committee on Climate Change has said. But it would also be surprising in a bad way if it was held to be way off the track that the CCC has already taken a lot of effort to flag up.
Thanks. And Sam, what are your views?
I mean, one thing that's sort of fascinating over the past, say, 18 months or so is the ease with which net zero by 2050 has entered the objective function of all manner of people. I mean, that was a sort of a quite courageous thing to legislate when it happened a year or so ago. And the Committee on Climate Change sort of almost pushed the analytical, technological, economic envelope to get the scenario that has net zero by 2050. And then the political process with Extinction Rebellion and school strikes and so on turned net zero by 2050 as to the slowest conceivable objective. If you look at the manifestos in the December election, 2050 was what the slow guys said. The progressive guys talked about 2030. So the expectation is clearly there. The willingness in the abstract is there. There's very little yet in terms of policies that make me think, we've moved the objective, we've tightened the objective, but we haven't accelerated the policies just yet. I think the power sector is well on its way. As we said, it's a matter of staying the course. So the power sector will be net zero, probably net negative, well before 2050. That's kind of lined up. The surface transport story is also lined up, a bit behind, but it's very hard to see how you would sort of stop the advent of the electric car. So that's lined up as well. So these things, and that takes care of whatever it is, 40% of emissions or something like that. So the big question marks are buildings and industry, where a lot still has to happen. It again goes back to that hydrogen economy that we have to build. So yeah, it's doable, but the signs that the politicians are actually doing it are not completely there.
And Ben, what do you think?
One thing that this year's events has taught us is that anything's achievable in a really short space of time. And I think many would argue that the climate emergency deserves the same amount of urgency and investment globally as the current pandemic. Clearly, the pandemic is in the forefront of everyone's mind. But if you look at what's happening in terms of carbon emissions, the impact that's having on the planet, then arguably that's as important. And therefore, I think if the same kind of energy and kind of willingness to get things done was put to that agenda, it's 2050 is absolutely achievable. But I think it has to come at the top of everybody's agenda, right from the top in terms of setting kind of regulatory and policy landscape, being at the forefront of private business and something that really engages domestic voters as well. You have to kind of capture really corny cliche, the hearts and minds of people. And personally, I feel that it'd be difficult to stimulate public interest to the level we need and change the behaviour of the masses unless there's a real everyday impact on all of us. And that could come in the way of, I guess, financial incentives to become more green or, via avoidable taxes.
So bearing all of that in mind, Arjan, from a government perspective, is net zero still a priority?
It is. It's not forgotten. The pandemic is now the major priority, understandably. But again, we have been working on the Energy White Paper. We've been discussing that within the department, so that was close to being ready to go, basically. But that has now been postponed, but it will still be there, and it's still necessary to give the government framework on how to reach 2050 target. But what the pandemic has made us think basically is to analyze the impact of the pandemic on our different kinds of policies. Particularly what's relevant is in the long term, we've seen it coming as well, where you have lower electricity demand on the system either because of more energy efficiency, as well as more decentralized electricity. Where you have that lower demand, what impact will that have on the system? So with the result of the pandemic now, where you've seen a drop in demand from particularly the industrial and commercial side, a slight increase from the household side, this has more or less figured it as a 15% drop in electricity demand. So what impact does it have on the system? That's make us think basically in the long term as well, because it's coming, it's now already materialized to a point.
So the message that's coming through loud and clear from all of you is that everyone has a huge part to play in contributing to the sustainability challenge and helping meet that net zero target. But thinking specifically about businesses, what role have businesses got in that net zero ambition? Ben, if I could come to you first.
I think it's huge. And for me, you know, it has to become one of the non-negotiables and embedded, I guess, right at the top of business in terms of corporate strategy and become a real focus point for the culture of an organization. So I don't think it can be something that's just part of a kind of company's KPIs and a tick box exercise. It's really got to drive the organization at its heart, and that's from recruitment. And if you speak, I've heard a lot of big businesses talk about how if they don't have their sustainability targets at the right place and at the right level, they don't believe that they're going to be able to attract the right young people, such as the kind of the change in kind of the younger demographic at the moment in terms of supporting the carbon agenda. So recruitment really important. Goes to your supply chain. You know, it's all well and good you having a really good carbon agenda and targets yourselves, but if everyone that supplies to you doesn't, then it can paint a bit of a muddy picture. And it comes down to everyday behaviours as well in your workforce and performance management. It's a really hard one to get, I think, to have a not just at the top of your leadership's agenda, but how, again, sorry to use it, but the hearts and minds of your people. But it is so important, and it does have to be so embedded in your culture, I think, in order for it to kind of properly live and breathe in businesses. And we're starting to see that now. We're starting to see strap lines from businesses that are very much built around the carbon agenda. And we're also starting to see some really ambitious targets as well on the private sector, where people are targeting themselves to be kind of negative carbon by a certain date. You know, even kind of the kind of big traditional oil companies have put really kind of stretching targets. So absolutely the right thing to do. It has to come from the top, but I think you have to find a way of kind of embedding that within your workforce, and that has to be part of your culture.
And Sam?
Yeah, I sort of had a conversation with a business representative a couple of weeks back, and he made the sort of the powerful claim that business is ahead of policy, or the sort of the enlightened half of, obviously the enlightened half of business. Obviously there's a tail of slower business leaders, but the sort of a lot of businesses get the transition, they understand it has to come, they sort of strangely thrive at the challenge. You know, they sort of like a good engineering challenge, and can we do zero carbon planes, and can we do zero carbon steel? There's some sort of machismo in the engineering community and sort of say, yes, we can do that, and I'm going to show you how we can do that. So all that, in a sense, is happening. It just needs to be nurtured and supported by policy. And then there's sort of the normal businesses, in inverted commas, that are not particularly carbon intensive. They're mostly electricity consumers and consumers of heating services. They just have to rationally manage their electricity consumption, energy efficiency measures, and in due course of the switch to non-gas-based heating. That's the role they can play, just sort of being very proactive in their energy management.
No, thanks. And Robert, what are your views?
Businesses have a really important role to play, and the role of corporate social responsibility is now much, much bigger in many businesses than it was 10 years ago, and extends way beyond energy. And in fact, one of the most hopeful signs, I think, is the way that discipline is growing and is encompassing energy and the whole value and values chain that businesses have. So I'd be quite hopeful that the kind of holistic view of social, environmental, commercial impact of businesses will encourage some quite big changes in behaviour, and will, you know, in terms of and the whole energy and the whole environmental impact will elevate it from the kind of functional to the more strategic. And this is here where consumers, again, can have a really big influence because they can call out the good and the bad that they see and show businesses what they need to do. I mean, you look at the drivers around, say, different agricultural standards that are coming up now in some of the Brexit debates, and you can see that consumer voice could become really, really important in determining how businesses conduct themselves to get the goods and services that consumers desire. So I think there's a bigger and wider agenda, which is really encouraging.
Oh, interesting. And Ian, what would government like to see from business on this?
Three things. So basically, I've seen more and more businesses committing to a net zero, which is good. It's good to see. But I think what we would like to see from a more government perspective is indeed for these businesses also to put the money where their mouth is. If they do commit to it, we're putting money into it with demonstration projects, funding programs. We expect businesses basically either to take those funding programs up with part of their own funding as well and support their own efforts and put their own money into achieving their own objective as well for net zero. Two other things, still to invest in energy efficiency. As mentioned before, that remains more than a challenge. And there you always have a bit of a different perspective between government and industry. For government, we apply always a bit of an economic analysis based on net present values and then net present energy efficiency that makes so much sense. But from an economic, purely commercial perspective, we have really short payback periods, all internal hurdles, limited budget. Even if it makes sense from a net present value perspective that government has, it may not make sense from a business perspective. I get that, but still in the long term, for a company, if a company wants to be competitive in the longer term and simply focusing on 1 year or 2 year, expect them to allocate more resource to increase their energy efficiency as well. The third thing what I expect business to do is with all the new technology changes, focusing on perhaps the bigger infrastructure projects coming through as well on CCS and hydrogen, is to think through business models, how you can integrate all of this. And that's where business is probably a better place, but better than governments to come up with a business model that makes commercial sense.
That's really interesting. Clearly, you all feel that business has a really important role to play in helping the UK meet that 2050 target. But as a final point, we asked each of you to give us your top predictions for the energy sector and how that will affect businesses over the short, medium and longer term. So with a sort of a look to the future, Sam, if I could start with you on this one.
Looking back 10 years, just sort of how wrong you can be and yet broadly right. So this is a dangerous thing. A couple of things. On the demand side, I would imagine in 5 years, probably certainly in 10, there will be that huge new block of demand from electric cars will be, significant and on the system. That sort of transition is happening, I think, much faster than a lot of people had anticipated. Obviously, there's still the sort of the consumer demand piece to watch out for, but the models are coming online, the car industry is on board. So I would say by 2030, there will be a significant sort of share of electric cars and associated demand and associated whatever that does to loads will have to be absorbed. So that's one thing that I expect to happen in those 10 years. A second one where I'm optimistic based on not too much research, just sort of a gut feeling conversations, is on storage. I think that in 10 years, we should have seen a solution to the storage problem much more prominent than we currently have it. So which in turn obviously will allow us to ramp up renewables even more. On nuclear and CCS, sort of the two technologies that haven't made it, I can't see a scenario where nuclear is having a comeback somehow. People talk about small reactors and maybe that might happen, but not in 10 years. So I think nuclear is kind of out of the story. It will be renewables and storage. And then on CCS, we need CCS. So the question is to what extent it will happen. I think it will happen in industry rather than in power. So we should have CCS associated with industrial processes. I don't think we need it in the power sector, and therefore we're probably not going to see it in the power sector. The other big sort of clunky, it's probably an unfair word, but the other big technology that we might see in 10 years is BECCS, I hope, for biomass and CCS. I know Drax, for example, are very bullish about it, and there's a few of the smaller sort of waste-to-energy type producers are keen. So negative emissions will become a business in 10 years, or starting to be a business in 10 years for power producers. So, yeah, come back in 10 and have an embarrassing conversation.
And Ian, what are your views?
So, again, over the short-term period will be the first pandemic economic recovery. And then in autumn, you probably see a whole swath of consultations and energy white paper net zero review from Treasury that will be published in the autumn. So that will then, and then it will be followed up by probably more consultation call for evidence. So that's basically for the next 12 months. In the medium term, two big things, which are more or less interrelated, is decarbonizing heat, as mentioned before. And the other one from a non-domestic perspective as well is links to decarbonizing industrial clusters, which you have to have basically have more or less CCS, but CCS is also relevant for hydrogen. So the CCS development with industry as well as in the power sector, and hydrogen for heat. So it all comes back to that point on CCS. So how will CCS technology and economics around it be developed in the medium term so that it can be rolled out for having place in the more long term? In the really long term, it's difficult to predict.
And Robert, from Cornwall's perspective, what do you think are the things to watch?
In the immediate term, cash preservation is key. That's likely to lead to a squeeze on investments that are perceived to be non-core in terms of how people contract for their energy. The credit position of individual companies is once again going to become incredibly important. You know, we're going to go back to the days of 2008 when people had real challenges to get energy supply contracts in many different sectors. So cash is going to be the key for the next couple of years. The desire to decarbonize isn't going to go away. As I mentioned in my comment earlier, I think localism is going to become incredibly important in environmental and thus energy policy. Air quality is going to be a really big issue in local elections, and will lead to some big tensions between regions and between national and local governments, particularly in the areas of transport and, to a lesser extent, heat decarbonisation. So there'll be a big push away from diesel vehicles in particular as a result of all of this. It'll be expressed in many different ways, but you can see in some of the changes in our cities already that some of the things that are happening. And they'll happen, and then drivers will need to adapt to them, which is where the political tensions will come from. And then at medium term, when, as I'm sure it will in the end, get better, you'll see the decarbonisation agenda accelerate. I think a lot of working patterns may change, especially for those fortunate enough to be able to work from home. Well, they may well work very differently than they did until recently. Good for them. I think you will find that there will be a bunch of people whose jobs have just disappeared. Looking after them will become a big political question, and that will stretch into affordability within energy. And then as we go out into the longer term, we get more opportunity for some big strategic decisions need to be taken before 2025, really, on decarbonisation of big urban heat, how we heat our homes in large urban environments. Within parts of industry, particularly where we have capital intensive heat sources that, with very long lifetimes. And we will need to put some more momentum back into power decarbonisation, if only to create the electricity to meet those new demands from displaced fossil fuels.
And finally, Ben, what do you think?
Right. So I think for me, the immediate 1 to 2 years is that COVID recovery. How quickly is demand going to recover? And what's the impact on projects that are either already underway and have had to stall or are going to be launched post COVID? And how does that kind of impact the kind of green agenda? And for me, I think what we'll start to see is greater clarity on net zero targets and mandates. I think it was gathering really good momentum pre-COVID. So I expect to see, as and when we kind of move out of the situation we're in at the moment, for that pace to continue. I really hope, as we talked about at the start, that's kind of driven from the very top. So I think those are the two for the immediate horizon. Medium term, you know, for me, I'm quite close to the market itself, and I can see a significant change in the structure of the markets. So that influx of renewables, wind and solar, really begins to bite. And I say bite, I don't necessarily mean that negatively, but it's just a change to what we've seen in terms of the volatility in the market. Wind can be there 1 minute, it's not going to be there the next. What impact that's going to have on prices of electricity contracts or the ability to be flexible in those markets, I think we're going to really see a huge emergence of that. Investment signs for flexibility, I think we're going to see them start to emerge and grow again. We talk about the kind of the missing money at the moment in terms of the investment in flexibility. You have to believe with the agenda being where it is that's got to improve. So within 2 to 5 years, hopefully the capacity market continues to recover price-wise. More value in kind of market arbitrage, that shape of the market, and being able to be flexible in that. Hopefully greater clarity and kind of implementation in terms of the significant charging review, forward-looking charges that gives customers a really clear roadmap to start to invest into and start to kind of properly plan their kind of net zero agenda. So that's kind of what I see in the next 2 to 5 years. I think EV projects will start to grow legs. It's already started, but at real pace, I think now over the next kind of 2 to 5 years. You know, I do think there'll be a focus on, or the potential to be the focus on REGOs. You know, will they go the way of LEX, or will they continue to be used as they are today? That'll be really interesting for me over the next 5 years. There might be some increase in commodity prices. I think I mentioned the way that the LNG project cycles work. So we could see demand, if we recover globally, start to outstrip supply. But again, it's a cyclical effect. Once those projects come online, we see it catch up. And so I don't see any huge rise, but there could be some periodic rise in commodity prices. And then if you look longer term scale, this is where it starts to become a lot more hazy, I think. But for me, it's what do I expect to see? Well, I think decentralization at scale, now, whether that be 5, 10, 15, 20 years, we're already starting that journey. You know, how close we can get to, you know, we're already starting to see some of the new kind of, electric cities, carbon-free cities, technology playing a much bigger role in the way that energy exists from businesses to communities. Things like peer-to-peer trading can start to become a reality when you've got those smart cities that kind of link up renewable energy, battery storage in the community. So, you know, whereas at the moment, I think, you know, we're starting to see it, but in pockets, you start to see that decentralization and carbon agenda really, really come to communities as well as businesses. But again, very hazy on the longer term, and hopefully we'll start to see a bit more clarity on whether that 2050 target is a reality.
Thank you so much to our experts for taking part in this discussion for the Future of Business Energy podcast for Empower Business Solutions Energy HQ. As they said, while it's interesting to look back almost a decade, it's more exciting to look to the future of the energy sector and the important role businesses will play as we work towards the target of net zero emissions by 2050. To download a copy of the Future Report 2020, please visit www.energy-hq.co.uk/Future Report 2020 or join the conversation using hashtag Future Report 2020.